In this afternoon's talk, I'd like to explore in more detail this theme of equanimity and finding balance in a world of change. And today's been one of those days where we've experienced a few different weather patterns outside. We've had the pouring rain and we've had the wind, and I can still feel the bright sun on my face at the moment, actually, from doing the walking meditation. Really strong sun now. And perhaps for all of us, or certainly for many of us, those outer patterns will have been mirrored, really, in terms of what's been happening for us today. So you can think back. You know, you arrived this morning, and all of the different things that may have been going on in your inner process, your experience today. Could have been moments of delight and pleasure, and moments of boredom, moments of really enjoying it, and moments of wondering why you came at all. So all of these things can kind of arise and pass in the course of a day. There are these changing inner conditions as well as these changing outer conditions. And equanimity is this quality that can find balance amidst all of those, that can make peace with all of those changes. Some of the things that we face at the moment can feel very contemporary. I mean, as well as doing the Dharma teaching, I also teach in a college. You know, I mean, all of those in public services at the moment, you know, this is a big time of change and difficulty and threat. Kind of financial crisis and environmental crisis that we have at the moment can feel very much of our time, and these are the particular challenges that we find ourselves faced with. And there's also a sense that these kind of challenges are universal, that they happen in all times and places. And this is why the Buddha's teaching still talks to us, really. Sort of philosophers and anthropologists have all these debates about whether there's a kind of universal human nature. And you know, I'm going to try and settle that now. But it seems to me to be interesting to say, you know, just to feel when we reflect on the Buddha's teachings, which is from a very different culture and a very different time, that there is so much that's familiar. Even thinking of something like the traditional list of hindrances we can find in meditation, and restlessness, or a mind that's wanting something different, a mind that's always looking for the next thing, or that feeling of, I don't want this, I want this to go away. Or, you know, wondering what it's about, and whether we're doing the right thing, or whether we should have done something different, or feeling very sleepy. I mean, this is a traditional list of the hindrances. I mean, these are things that we experience now, and these are things that were written about so long ago. The experience of being separated from what we want, of being connected with what we don't want, of having a body that will get sick, a body that ages, and a body that will die. All of these experiences are really universal experiences. Yeah, universal experiences. So it seems to me that just as human beings, we're asked, what is it to find equanimity? What is it to find balance? What is it to make peace with all of those changes? One of the things that can make it difficult is that although all around us is reminders of change and uncertainty and impermanence, there can also be this quite built-in expectation of security, or expectation of permanence, or expectation that things will stay the same. And Stephen Batchelor, who teaches here, I know many of you will know, he describes once how he was going to take a photograph. And he's also, as well as teaching meditation, very keen on photography. And he saw this particular pattern. I think he was going for a walk and he saw this, and he didn't have his camera with him. He thought, okay, I'll come back tomorrow and capture this. This will make a really good photo. And of course he came back tomorrow, and the light was subtly different. And it was gone. It was gone. And again, they're just realizing the sort of ephemerality of things. We think that appearance, for instance, can be something relatively solid. And actually a discipline like photography really makes you so aware of things like changing light and changing patterns. You know, you might look at a photograph and think, oh, that's me. You realise if somebody had turned the light on or had a different lighting or a different setting on the camera, that you'll say, looking at that's me, would have looked so different. So these things are much more unstable than we sometimes imagine. A really good question to reflect upon is whether impermanence is intrinsically painful. Is there anything built into impermanence and change that necessarily makes it difficult? You know, is impermanence necessarily bad news? Or is it more something to do with our relationship to it? That it's the resistance or the not wanting to know or the pretending it's not there that makes impermanence difficult. But in itself, it's just what it is. It's just things coming and going. It's only the demand or the expectation that things should be otherwise that can make us struggle and make it tough. In the Buddhist tradition, there's this word dukkha, which is sometimes translated as suffering or unsatisfactoriness. But has these two meanings, really. So it can refer to a quality of experience, in which case suffering or unsatisfactoriness is, you know, really good translations. Or it can refer to a characteristic of things, which is quite interesting. So, the traditional teaching is that all conditioned things are dukkha. So that would include even this, lovely Dharma book I've got here from Sharon Salzberg, the Loving Kindness book. It's interesting to think in what sense is a book dukkha, or in what sense is a bell or a glass. And this is where the translation of suffering seems a bit, it doesn't work really in English so well. I mean, it doesn't seem to make sense to say the book is suffering, you know, or the glass is suffering, or the bell is suffering. And another word that really captures dukkha in that sense is unreliable. So all conditioned things, we might say, are unreliable. Unreliable to try to make a permanent home in. Unreliable as a source of well-being. It's like we're trying to grip it and grasp it and think, that's it. So if I decide this book is really where it's at, you know, this is the secret of my well-being. It might actually be in terms of the content, but not necessarily in terms of the material object. And I hold that, and this is mine. This is what's going to really do it for me. Then what happens if one of you also decides that the book is the source of your well-being? Then we're going to start to struggle and fight. Or what happens if I leave it on the train? Yeah. Or in time when it begins to fade. Yeah. So it's that very process of trying to grasp and cling and hold on to that which is unreliable, that which shifts, that can create this sense of dis-ease. I like this image of a broken bike. Yeah. You imagine a broken bike and the wheels buckled and the brakes don't work. That bike in itself has no possibility of making you suffer. If it's just there, a broken bike, that's fine. But if you get on it and try and ride it somewhere, you know, then you'll fall off and hurt yourself. Yeah. So what do I mean by getting on the bike? It's like if we get a job and think, right, that's it. This is the one. This is the thing I've been waiting for. Now everything's going to be okay. Or this is the relationship, or this is the living situation, or this is the experiences of travel, or whatever it is, and we think we've somehow got it, some conditioned thing that's going to bring some kind of completeness. That's when we're getting on the bike, if you like. Yeah? And doing that, in Dharma language, means taking birth. Yeah? In mental sense, taking birth. And taking birth leads to old age, leads to sickness, leads to death. So, it's also helpful to remember that nobody is immune to this. It doesn't matter how fortunate you are in life, or how many kind of good experiences you've had, that nothing really can make us immune from this pattern of change, this pattern of being faced with things we don't want. Obviously, in different situations in life, those things take very different forms. And for some people that can be very strong and very kind of intense sense of suffering or disease. And for other people it might be much more subtle. So the particularities differ. But we all face these conditions. Interestingly, that reflection in itself is a doorway to compassion. A doorway to compassion. You see, we are all in the same boat, really. We get that feeling of all being in the same one, all brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death, as some teachers used to say. Yeah? But we're connected in that way. So equanimity knows that we face what are called the eight vicissitudes: pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. You know, so whatever situation you're in, these things will come to you. I mean, even as strange as it may sound to us, really, you know, even the Buddha got his fair share of blame. You know, I don't know if you know the story, but at one stage I think his cousin tried to kill him. And in the early stages of setting up the community, you know, certain rivalries and monks and nuns not doing what they should be doing, and certain difficulties. And, somebody told me once, I'm not sure exactly where it is, but somewhere in the suttas, you know, the Buddha says things like, "I've got a bad back." You know, so there's the kind of the humanity in there that all of these things are faced by all of us, really. I had quite an interesting experience with this last week myself, actually, because I was on. I live in Nottingham, and I was on the regional news called BBC East Midlands Today, just talking about mindfulness. You know, just on there for a minute or so, and I was pleased to be doing that, and it was nice to be on the news and be able to talk a little bit about mindfulness, and I'm afraid not completely immune from, oh look, I'm on the telly kind of thing. I don't know if, you know, you'll all be on that, but anyway, there's a little bit. And just to do this thing where I was perhaps a little bit more exposed than usual. And it's very interesting to see the sort of different reactions that you get from different people. And in terms of all these sort of quite, almost the full spectrum of praise and blame you can get from doing something like that. Something that was really good, and other people sort of don't mention it. And you know, other people sort of make one or two sarcastic comments or things like that. But it's just quite interesting, really, to reflect on that. You know, whatever you do, that it seems to invite these different responses. And and just sort of making peace with that, really. I mean, I know it's a great pattern for many of us, isn't it, to seek a sense of well-being by gaining the approval of others. But the approval of others is pretty unstable, you know. It's a pretty unstable thing, even if you do something good. Yeah. So, equanimity is about... also about having a balanced and sustained view. Yeah, a balanced and sustained view. So not being so thrown around by all of the different experiences in life. So when there's something pleasurable, suddenly thinking everything's so wonderful. or when something's painful, suddenly thinking it's so terrible. But somehow having this sense of perspective that that understands in the midst of all of those experiences that they're never the totality. So things are rarely as good or as bad as we might imagine. And, you know, what we see as a bad experience may turn out to have good elements in it, and what we see as a good experience may turn out to have unforeseen negatives to it. And it's very often quite mixed. And when we lose equanimity, we lose that kind of perspective, and things are kind of blown out of proportion, really. Again, I'll give you an example from my work in the college, where we often have all kinds of quite intense debates about various things, and one of them has been about the timetable. And you know, you have the 4 o'clock school, you know, we should finish at 4 o'clock, and then there's the 4:10 faction. And they, don't listen to the 4 o'clock school. And it's interesting, and again, I'm certainly not claiming to be totally beyond becoming quite kind of drawn into that. But it's just really interesting what can happen when these things, the kind of perspective closes down, and something that might be relatively unimportant, or even perhaps absolutely unimportant, can become so solid and, you know, so kind of tense and difficult to negotiate. And there's a kind of stuckness about that, this lost perspective. And so reflecting on how these things that can be seen as a good thing can have these difficult aspects, and things that can be seen as a bad thing can have these good aspects. I mean, you may well be familiar, it's quite a well-reported finding of some of the research on happiness, that after 6 months, there's not that much difference between the happiness of someone who's won the lottery and the happiness of someone who's had, you know, quite a serious accident. It was extraordinary finding that, really. Extraordinary finding. And again, we can think about, you know, when you really reflect it, reflect upon it, what, say, winning the lottery might do to your relationships, and can unbalance all kinds of things, you know, the sort of a kind of harmony that might be there. And again, all the different reactions you might get from people, and that envy that might be born of that. Not being able to trust people all of a sudden, and sort of feeling that people are only talking to you for your money. And, perhaps, again, the fantasy that everything would only be okay if I won the lottery. And then you've, wow, right, it's in the face, and I've won this thing. I've got what I always wanted, but still, there's a struggle. Still, there's a difficulty. Everything would be okay if I only didn't have to go to that horrible job. And now you don't have to go to that horrible job, and there's still something tough there. And then, so too, it just this extraordinary thing of how people can recover from, very difficult and traumatic experiences. Again, I mean, I'm lucky enough to have the use of my legs, and I can, I can use my legs and walk and run. And I don't want to underestimate the great, tremendous loss that I would feel personally, if I had an accident that meant I was a wheelchair user. And again, it's important, in talking about equanimity, I don't want a kind of pink fluffy cloud view of equanimity. You do a bit of equanimity practice and then suddenly, you could have a disabling accident, you'd be fine the next day or something. I mean, it's a real teaching. I mean, the point I was reflecting on there is, if you think about people who are wheelchair users, are they all kind of sitting around going, oh no, I'm in a wheelchair the whole time? They're not, they're sort of enjoying life and experiencing ups and downs, and, in the midst of all of that. So again, these things that we might think so wonderful can have difficulties. Things that we might think so unbearable, somehow can be coped with, people can work with them. You know, so countless examples, I'm sure you can think of many yourself, but you know, people who are carers, and people say, how do you do that? How do you do that? And yet somehow people find a way, very often. And again, if when people are divorced, again, tremendous loss of being divorced, but it's not uncommon to hear people describe that as a time when new opportunities arose, when they could grow in a different way, when they had an opportunity to be somebody different. And so too getting married, which is again a wonderful thing, a joyful thing, but so too brings new challenges, new difficulties. Getting promoted at work too might be tough. Elements of that that are difficult. And again, people who lose their job at times say, yeah, it was really difficult, but having lost that, again, it opened up new avenues. So again, we're just seeing here how what's up, what's down, what's pleasurable, what's painful, what's good, what's bad, might be much more nuanced than we might first imagine. And equanimity is really, really keeping hold of that perspective. One of my favourite sayings of John Peacock, who often teaches here, is that the opposite of attachment is not detachment, but engagement. Yeah? The opposite of attachment is not detachment, but engagement. I think it's a lovely phrase that really captures the active and engaged and sensitive and connected nature of practice, as opposed to practice being something that's going to somehow, you know, make us like a bit of wood, you know, totally kind of unfeeling and unmoved by life. And it's really helpful to bring that to mind when we talk about equanimity. You know, equanimity is not a dull quality, it's not a dead quality, it's not a grey quality that says, everything's somehow the same. So in a way there's something rather paradoxical about it. It's about being connected with life, being moved by life, but not being so thrown around by it. I remember asking Christina Feldman once about how she and Christopher Titmus were founding Gaia House, and said, "How did you do that?" Because I mean, to me, you know, if you're just there with nothing or very little, and think, "How are you going to suddenly create this centre? How are you going to do that?" And all the activity and all the things that will have been needed to have been done to create that. And she said something again, which always stuck with me really, but that it was an inner stillness. It was an inner stillness and a connection with inner stillness that gave her the ability to act effectively. Yeah. So the inner stillness was not something passive, but was able then for the actions to be effective. And you know, I certainly know that from my own experience, really. If you come back from a long retreat or an intense retreat, and you can suddenly find this energy to do things that you've been procrastinating about for a long time. Yeah. And suddenly, wow, it would sort all these things out. And again, this sense of equanimity not being a cold quality. If we think of the Dalai Lama, I mean, I don't think anybody sees him as a cold person. You know, sort of embodiment of warmth and kindness and compassion. Again, I've heard a story about a Zen teacher, which to me again really is a beautiful sense of what practice is about, who was officiating at a funeral, and it was a funeral of his friend, and you know, he was sort of saying the prayers and the reflections of impermanence. I mean, I don't know what the exact words would be in the Zen tradition, but you know, it could be something like form is impermanence, feeling is impermanence, perception is impermanence, and this sort of quite what might appear philosophical, but this sort of profound teaching on impermanence, he'd be doing all that. And then he'd stop and start to cry. And he'd really be crying because he missed his friend and he was moved by his friend and it was upsetting. It was upsetting. I wasn't saying it wasn't. And so he'd cry for a bit and then, you know, form is impermanence, feeling is impermanent. And I just, you know, I love that sense really. That the practice is about a liberation, but that liberation isn't a coldness or a deadness. Yeah. Enlightenment is to be intimate with all things. Yeah, it's been said. And so too there can be this paradox with equanimity about whether it makes us care more or care less. Yeah. And again, an example from the Zen tradition, there's quite a practice of taking care to put your shoes carefully, you know, outside the hall when you come to sit, so that they're all nicely in a row. And again, this is a very good mindfulness practice, so rather than just thinking, oh, you know, I'll take my shoes off, get into the hall, and that's when the serious practice starts, you know. But actually, no, really respecting this moment and taking care over those small things. So on one level, equanimity is not being so bound up with things, not being so caught up with things, not being so picky about things. You know. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose, yeah, to be less picky. But then also to be careful, to pay more attention, to have a kind of reverence for the small details of life. I mean, maybe really what I'm just saying is equanimity is about caring more and being less neurotic. Yeah. But it's that subtle sense of, do things matter more or do they matter less? Another thing I personally find quite helpful about equanimity is to include within it an equanimity about our own reactions to things. So there isn't too much of an ideal of how I should be. And our own varying reactions can also be met with equanimity. And an example of this was, for me personally, was when I was on the train in Birmingham, actually. And it was a really crowded train. And those of you who live in London will know all about crowded trains. And the train was getting to the stop, and there were quite a few people in front of me. And I don't know if you had this experience, but I wasn't quite sure whether the few people in front of me were going to get off or not. And I wasn't even aware of it, but I think I must have been sort of edging towards, you know, the way you sort of do, the kind of asking with your body, are you going to get out of the way or not? And I'd obviously done this in a way that the person in front of me felt had been a bit aggressive to him. Yeah. He sort of turned around to me and said, yeah, hang on, mate, we're all getting off as well. So I was like, okay. A bit taken aback by that. And to me, this is just a little story of all the bumping into each other that we have in urban environments. I'm sure we've all had lots of these. But I noticed, you know, when he said that to me, that, you know, my heart started to beat a bit more quickly and my stomach started to feel a bit kind of uneasy. And then there were these sort of thoughts that arose. You know, that was a bit unfair. I didn't know you were getting off. I didn't mean anything by that. You know, why are you talking to me like that? I'm a meditation teacher. All that sort of thing. So all these things start to go around. And really to feel equanimity about that response. Yeah? Because there can be a feeling, and I've certainly got into that trap before, of, oh, I'm not supposed to feel that. I'm supposed to be equanimous. He said that to me. You know, so, and then you try and put a lid on all of that stuff. But a lot of those reactions are probably pretty animal, really, you know. There's this sort of sense of fear, and all these things come. So to be equanimous about those times when we do feel a little bit off balance, you know, it's really not the end of the world. It's not the end of the world. You know, it was just the next breath is a chance to come back. Again, I don't know if you have this as practitioners, but whether whether ideals can become oppressive at times. You know, so the time when you're a bit snappy with someone, or your times when you're not so mindful, or somehow we don't meet our ideals. You know, can we also bring kindness and equanimity to those times too, without building them up into some big story? I've been practicing for X amount of years and I still do that, or something, you know, as if it's, yeah. So it's also about kind of letting our visions or our ideals be sources of inspiration rather than new sources of kind of oppression and inner criticism. Talking about equanimity too, it's really important to just acknowledge the real depth and intensity of suffering there can be. I think it's important not to talk too blandly or loosely, in a way that can somehow make it sound really easy. And there are, you know, again, just to perhaps state the obvious, but it just feels important to include this. You know, our states of real despair, people can find themselves in real despair. And really intense physical, political sufferings. And I think equanimity is certainly not trying to deny any of that. It's somehow about holding that view or that vision within a bigger perspective. And again, there's just a personal memory here. I remember as a teenager going through a difficult time, and I mean, teenagers tend to. But there was just a particular time, and I was really sort of in quite a despairing state of mind, really. And I was very lucky at the time to have my stepmum around, who was just great at being able to sort of hold that, really. And I remember saying something like, it's never going to get better, you know, it's going to be like this all the time, it's just horrible, it's terrible. And, you know, that was the mind state that I was really in. And she was just able to say, it will. And then I said, no, it won't, stop saying that. it won't. And I always remember that. And I think, I just have the feeling, memory is a tricky thing, isn't it? You know, what's the memory and what's reconstructed afterwards. But I just sort of have this feeling that it was as if 99.9% of me was lost in that. But just to have somebody representing that little bit, that little chink of light, was so helpful to just give some perspective to that. So I think equanimity is not about denying those experiences of despair or loss or difficulty, but just saying that they're never the whole story. And, you know, as we were talking about with some others earlier, that's part of this sense of meditation and mindfulness, that there can be all these things going on, these storms or difficulty, but it can be held. And there may be, in a way, that's a nice image of what practice can help us do, really. That holding is something that at times we might need another person to do that. They're reflecting that other perspective or other possibility. But also, too, we can feel that in our own experience. You know, we can begin to have an inner refuge that can be relied upon. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of when the Buddha met a woman who just lost her baby and was in, you know, very profound grief, very profound distress about that. And she said to him, you know, can you help me? How can you help me? And, you know, what can you do? I desperately need your help. And his response to that was to ask her, I think, to get a seed. I think it was a mustard seed. This is from memory. From a house in which nobody had died. You know? Nobody had died. And then once she collected this seed, she could come back to him and he would be able to help her. So of course she went round the village and said, you know, I need to know if anybody died in this house. And they said, you know, I'm sorry, we can't help you. I'd love to help, I can't help you, but you know, our uncle recently passed away. And then of course she goes to another house and, you know, my brother's recently passed away or my grandfather's passed away. And of course as she does this, she realizes that at every house has known death. Every house has known loss. And doing that then reframes her experience. So it's not a denial of the loss, it's not a denial of the despair, but it's a reframing of it from the personal perspective. Why is this happening to me? This is so unfair, it's happening to me. To something more universal. You know, touching into something much more universal. Equanimity can also be seen as both the ground and fruit of practice. In other words, it's something that really helps us to deepen in our practice, and it can be the expression of the fruit of our practice. Okay? Those of you who are familiar with the Buddhist scriptures will realize that equanimity turns up in many of the different lists, the different teachings. It's part of the paramis, the 10 paramis, part of the 7 factors of awakening, part of the Brahma Viharas. And just to get a sense of what that means as something living, the factors of awakening are things that really help us to see clearly. We can get a sense of how practice at times can gather a momentum. Perhaps we can particularly see this on retreat, but perhaps at other times too. How the mindfulness, the strong sense of mindfulness, leads to really investigating our experience, looking deeply into our experience. And that brings with it a sense of energy, a brightness, which is very joyful. And that joy then allows the mind to be calm, to be tranquil, to be concentrated. And those are the conditions that really, out of which equanimity is born. Again, we can feel this in a very practical way on retreat sometimes. You know, you have that experience when you can just have this very open awareness as we were practicing with earlier. And there can just be this stillness and all these, you know, these thoughts are coming and going, the feelings are coming and going. Bodily sensations are coming and going. Memories are coming and going. But there can be this sense of a spacious awareness that includes and allows it all. We're not so caught up in it. It's not, none of it's troubling, none of it's difficult. Now, some of it's quite funny, really. Watch the play of the mind. Just watch the play of the mind. But there's a profound stillness in the middle of it. And two, equanimity takes its place among the paramis, which may be seen as the characteristics or qualities that really embody practice. You know, as we take practice into the world, the sense of generosity or ethical practice, sense of patience. Equanimity too can be a real gift to the world. The thing that really deepens our equanimity is to do with the clarity of our vision, really. To do with the clarity of our vision. Some years ago, I was in Dharamsala in India, in northern India. And this is where many Tibetan exiles are. I'm sure many of you have been there. And you, if you go there, you can go and have teachings at the library, which are really, it's a wonderful thing to do. You sort of go down the hill from McLeod Ganj, which is where many people stay, and then there's this library. And you know, all these maroon robed monks and nuns and doing their full prostrations to the Lama, and they hear this teaching in Tibetan and it's translated into English, and it's just it's quite a wonderful thing to be a part of. And I remember being at some of these teachings, and at the time my one of my impressions of it was it all seemed incredibly philosophical. And whether you've if you come across Nagarjuna, and Nagarjuna's work can be very, very philosophical, and there's a lot of debates, pretty abstract and theoretical debates about inherent existence and trying to show the emptiness of inherent existence of all things, and they have all these things that sound tremendously philosophical. But the more I have sort of reflected on those kind of teachings, and the more I've really tried to practice with them, to see that while it may appear philosophical, it's really talking about a vision which transforms our way of being, our way of perceiving, our way of acting in the world, our way of speaking. There's a very intimate connection with how solid we perceive things to be and the patterns of craving or aversion that can keep us so stuck. There's an intimate connection with seeing the emptiness of solidity of phenomena and this quality of equanimity. Emptiness of solidity of phenomena. Often on retreat, many of us find ourselves looking forward to the end. It's quite a common experience. And this has arisen for me many times. And it's something I reflected upon, really. And you can reflect on this in terms of emptiness. Now, where is the end of a retreat, really, when you think about it? You know, and I was thinking, is it sitting in a taxi, leaving Gaia House? Is that going to be so wonderful? And then you find yourself looking forward to it. Is it going to be so great to sit in a taxi? And then what's at the end of the taxi? You get to Newton Abbott Station. And it's a railway station. You know, you're waiting for the train. Is that so wonderful, really? Is that the thing that I'm really putting so much, placing so much on, that it's going to be so great? You know, being on that train, which is quite often quite packed and overcrowded. And you just can kind of deconstruct the appearance of solidity. The end of the retreat is going to be so wonderful. But the end of the retreat, in a sense, doesn't have a solid existence at all. When you look at it, it begins to dissolve. And that's so true with so many of the things that we can want and crave and try and fix and grasp, that they really lack that. I mean, again, a new job. I've got a new job. But is a new job really a thing? You know, there's the journey to the job, there's the being there, there's the feeling a bit anxious about how it's going to go. Maybe also, too, there's the experience of everyone saying, wow, wonderful, you got a new job, and the buzz of that, which when you pay attention to it, it's not that different from the buzz of a nice chocolate. Comes, gives you a bit of a hit, and then fades. You got a new job, great. And then they start talking about something else. you know, so how solid are these things that we can put so much of our emotional energy into? And again, just to be clear, I'm not saying that we shouldn't go for a new job. I'm certainly not saying we shouldn't be pleased about having a new job. I'm not saying we should all stick in the one we've got. It's the thing is that investment. This is going to do it. It's the investment that is born of the delusion that it's something solid and something that's going to deliver. And equanimity is born of letting go of the illusion of solidity. As we let go of that illusion, again, this really touched quite tangibly a stillness and coolness associated with that. So let's just sit together just for a couple of minutes, just to allow the words to settle. May we make peace with all things and all moments. May we live with equanimity. May we find balance in a world of change. May all beings be free from fear and danger. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings live with ease.